Hello and welcome to This Anthro Life. I'm your host, Adam Gamwell. Today, I'm talking with Ashley Meredith. And Ashley is a cultural anthropologist for the Office of the National Archives of the Federated States of Micronesia. Yes, you heard that correctly. Her job title is actually cultural anthropologist. And in case you're not familiar, Micronesia is a sovereign island country in Oceania, situated northeast of Australia and Papua New Guinea. It consists of 600 or so islands covering a massive area of around 1 million square miles. And there's 18 languages spoken across the islands. So, Ashley's got her work cut out for her. Now, what's really interesting about this is the many levels that Ashley works at as a cultural anthropologist. Now, echoing what we might call a traditional fieldwork approach, Ashley works with a team to document, preserve, and establish cultural pathways for different Micronesian communities. This includes work like demographics, surveys, linguistic studies, and observational fieldwork. But her work is also what we can call applied anthropology. She talks with communities to understand what they want in terms of infrastructure, tourism, education, or heritage development, and works with them to find resources, generate funding, and support. And beyond this, she interfaces between communities, government, and international relations, including with the United States and UNESCO. So Ashley's breadth of experience provides a key perspective for rethinking how we use data and what the role of anthropology is in today's world. Now, this includes why we need qualitative data in a world obsessed with numbers, but also how transmission matters. As we explore in this conversation, transmission has to do with cultural practices like storytelling as much as with technological limitations, such as internet speed across the islands. Now, our conversation kicks off here, so let's jump into it right after this. In terms of the ethnographic side of your work, how do you kind of pick the things that you study? Like, is in terms of fish markets or what folks are working on? So obviously, we'll get to some cultural heritage sites, you know. But I'm curious, like in this, like, is it the everyday examples also? Like, how does that pop up in your radar of things to focus on?
The way we figure out which or what we're going to document, we go to the communities and we ask them what they would like to see happen and what would be the most useful to them. And so when I first arrived in Yap, that's exactly what we did. We talked with the chiefs because, you know, there's a different protocol on each of the islands. Even if you go to the outer islands, there's still a protocol to follow. So in Yap, we talked with the chiefs who represent their communities, and then they identify a topic or a few topics that we can work with. And then provide that back to them so that it's useful to them in some way. Sometimes it's a matter of, we just want this documented. And sometimes it's a matter of, we would really like more information about this so that we can utilize it for whatever activity. So when I arrived in Koh Shai, actually the first thing we did was we did an ethnographic training. So part of my work initially was to train my coworkers in what I do so that we can have a team. And then the other part of the training evolved and incorporated the elders who we would interview so that they could know about the process. Instead of just surprising them and saying, hey, let's do an interview, it became much more of a conversation with them. And they guided the process and they helped to design and inform the research design that we ultimately employ when we do ethnographic surveys. And so when we were in the communities asking them, you know, after we did the training, hey, what would be most beneficial? What is it you want to do in your communities? They wanted to do a lot more trail guide work. They wanted to have places for visitors to go. They want to share their island with visitors, mostly through trails and historic sites. And so that's how we found out what they wanted was the research design development process, which was the first part of my work. And then them telling us the traditional routes is what they wanted to focus on. And then that actually turned into a bunch of other stuff. The conservation area, it helped to connect parts of the island from the past to today, and then to the, you know, between the communities. So it really, it's a common phrase in anthropology, but it really did develop a deeper understanding about the interconnectivity on the island and the reasons people would walk as far as they did, or, you know, now they'll drive. That's those topics. But in terms of fishing and the markets, that's just that's like everyday living. And it somehow comes into play as we carry out field work, keeping those things in mind. If we meet up with someone who's, you know, we're supposed to interview with them and they cancel on us, it might be because they need to go fishing that day because it's a better day than the day before. So there are a lot of daily life things that me and my coworkers need to be aware of, so that, you know, our expectations aren't too high, and, you know, expectations can upset people. So it's good to just go with the flow, literally.
That makes me think that, I mean, that's a really interesting framework, and it reminds me a bit of the fieldwork I did in Peru for my graduate degree, that working with indigenous farmers, you know, the schedule of when we would have meetings would be dictated sometimes by just like, okay, well, I couldn't harvest yesterday, I have to do it today, or something like there's a lot more like daily things that can like shift when you would have a meeting. How, in your experience, I'm curious, since you're employed to do this, you know, I mean, I guess a PhD student could be too, like as a graduate doing field work, but I mean, like, since this is your employment, how does that square away? Or does that work well in terms of like, we already know we're in Micronesia and the government is okay with the kind of changing schedule nature of things or going with the flow? Like, how does that affect the way they think about work? Yeah. And your work too, in terms of like scheduling interviews or documentation with folks.
I think in general, the expectation is that we're at least part of the office. Whether we're actually in the office, that depends on whether we have field work or not. I would say that things are flexible. We do talk with people after hours. So I might have a longer lunch. I mean, my field work is really like with my coworkers as everyone's schedule can allow. We always prioritize the elders because we never know what's going to happen with them. They are older. They could have health problems, or they could be getting their grandkids that day. And you know what? We'd rather them spend time with their grandkids than tell us oral history, because that's the transmission right there, you know? So I think overall the government's very flexible with the kind of work that we do, but it's not abused. I think that our team is really into, like, they're enthusiastic about what we're doing. They see things come into fruition, which is very different than like working with an abstract model. You actually get to see the results of your work pretty quickly. The reports take time, of course. The government agencies overall are pretty understanding about it. But we do have to keep in mind a lot of people's schedules, not just ours. And telling people when we want to do something doesn't always work out. If we get canceled on two or three times, then we might understand that they really just don't want to be interviewed. And so we don't push it. It's really if they want to be. If they want to share, then they share what they can. It depends on the island, but sometimes the thinking is that if you tell the whole story that you may pass away soon. So some people don't really want to tell much, or they won't tell anything at all because of that belief. Knowledge is power. And I think that they're keenly aware of that. It's an important value. Not everybody can be a navigator or a chief or whatever role. Everyone has a role, and it's seen in that way. So if you want to know about navigation, you need to talk to a navigator. You don't go and talk to somebody else who's not a navigator. So it's either them or it's nothing. Some topics they just might not talk about, or they'll tell part of it, and that's okay. I mean, you can never get the whole story out of someone. I mean, the way I think of it is somebody is 80 years old and they're going to tell me about navigation. They're going to take about 80 years to tell me about navigation. Like, they've been alive that long. They probably have a lot to say. And their knowledge as a navigator isn't just this linear interaction. It's knowledge of lots of things and bringing it all together. I mean, navigators have a very, very, they have a delicate role, if you ask me. They have to be good with people. They have to know medicine. They have to know how to get from A to B, and they have to know animals, and, you know, there's so many things that they have to know, because when you're on a boat with a few other people and you're maybe having a version of cabin fever, what do you do to keep the morale up? I mean, you got to know a lot of stuff. So, and that's just one example. So each person has a very significant role, and I figure it'd take a lifetime to tell me all about it. So I don't ever expect that someone's going to tell me the whole story to begin with. I just feel honored that they're going to share part of a story.
That's a really interesting idea. There's a belief that knowledge is power. And so sharing it may have some kind of implications for one's own, I don't know, like energy. It almost seems. I mean, yeah, this makes me think in terms of like the overproduction of knowledge that we have in other parts of the world. you know, and it is both power, but then also like, is it, I mean, it's kind of the flip side is like, by giving out that knowledge, you are reducing one's power, reducing one's energy almost too.
Yeah, I think so. And your usefulness to society as well. If someone's seeking your guidance, that's a whole other story, but it's still a kind of knowledge sharing. It sounds like an energy transference, a usefulness, or the perceived will to live, maybe. I'm not saying that people tell stories so that they can die off or anything. You know, if you tell everything, then maybe there's just not the purpose there the way that it might have been before. It's a concept that I don't fully understand, admittedly, but I do know that when we talk to some of the elders, that they sometimes they'll defer and say, you know, I'm not going to talk about that now, or I'm just not going to talk about it, and they'll talk about something else, and that's fine. I have had some interviews though with people for, I've had to come back, and we talked, I think, a total of 16 hours. One of my favorite ways of data collection is something that I don't even know if it's a term that everybody else uses, but me and my graduate advisor called it an ethnographic walkthrough. And so what this means is we go to a place, or we do something together, and it's almost like an elicitation device, and it's a conversation. So I don't provide a question transcript. I don't think that that's as holistic as we can be, but also other things come up that are important to them. And then overall in Micronesia, that it just wouldn't work. Like, history starts from a place, from a topic. And so that's how we collect oral history, is from a topic. So we do ethnographic walkthroughs so that we can be comfortable together, that we can understand the context of the topic, and also start the topic. So sometimes people can literally walk through a site. Other times we drive around the island and have conversations in the car with each other. And that's the activity. And it's just being together is the important part, that we're having that that shared understanding, or developing the shared understanding about what is being shared. And sometimes it takes me a while because I don't have all the historical backdrop that the person telling me has the story.
I mean, it makes me think of the anthropologist Keith Basso is, you know, wrote about, like, wisdom sits in places, in terms of working with the Apache too, in terms of that, like, place names are stories. Very cool to kind of think of the echo there. So literally it could be walking through a site. It could be driving through a certain area, and then that can elicit stories. Are places named? I mean, I'm not trying to make a comparison with the Apache, but, like, are there like place names in similar ways, in terms of, like, this is named whatever, and, like, the name is like the rock where two things happened. Or I'm just curious, like, how does naming work amongst folks in the different islands?
They're usually descriptive. I'm trying to think of a good example. So, like, a valley, it'll literally be like, if you break the words apart, it might be something that's like dug out. So what we know in English as valley, it's not going to be transliterated into Kashrayan, for example. It's going to be the way that someone might look at the landscape up into a valley, and they see something that's cut out. And so the word might translate to be cut out. Sometimes it can be like two things happened here. There's also, not necessarily in all languages in Micronesia, but sometimes a word can be ascribed to a place or a thing, and that word actually is a reference to another word that is very rarely spoken. And so it's like a double language. Sometimes it's dubbed as a secret language. It's like with any language, you have codes on codes on codes. And when we learn a second language, or if we're learning two languages in the home, we have our code switching and our code mixing. And it's kind of similar when communicating with a Micronesian in a Micronesian language, that you have code mixing and code switching, and that other person who's receiving the words or the symbols, they will either know or they don't know. And if they don't know, then they're not in possession of the information that they need to have to do this other thing. So it's a little bit complicated, and it takes time. That's another thing that can happen with the place names. I do keep track of place names as we go along, and I keep track of sometimes when they came into being used, even if it's not necessarily a local place name, so to speak. So, like, Micronesia, Melanesia, Polynesia, that was important for us for a while, and taking note of when that word came into existence to describe where we are and who started it, that was important for our knowledge for a while, which is really interesting anyway.
They tell some interesting like global and then local stories too, I imagine, you know. The question of like language and names, and if you know kind of the code switching or like, you know, double languages, that also seems to speak to this idea of knowledge is power, right? And that like there's also like a localness to it, right? That like how much do you really know? And even if I tell you, do you actually know what I'm saying? You know, like how deep do we actually ever get, or how can we, you know, how deep can we get, which I think is really, really interesting. And I'm curious, like your perspective in this too. So as like a cultural anthropologist, sociolinguist, like working in Micronesia for a while now, how many years have you been working in this space?
I started in January of 16. I've been working with the governments there since then, continuously. During the pandemic, I needed to come back to the States. So I've continued to work, but remotely. And at first it was, let's see, 14 months in Yap, and then it's been Koshai mostly. It doesn't really matter which island I'm on. I still work with the other offices remotely. So I'm always in a remote working situation, but I'm on the ground in the location where field work is more concentrated or in need of more training or something about that island is why I'm physically present. But if the other offices need me, then my office and their office coordinate and they'll move me there temporarily, like for a couple of weeks for field work or a training or whatever it is that is needing me on the ground there. So we have to always adapt in that way. And it's not easy to move around in the islands. There are, you know, we're talking about a million square miles.
That's huge.
It is huge. And it's about 600 islands. And I think it's around, 150 that have like human settlements. But from our perspective, all the islands are inhabited because they're incorporated into maybe subsistence, or if there's a certain rite of passage or a certain route that you have to go to make sure you show respect, especially for the navigators, then all the islands are getting utilized. So think of it like, so I think in the States, we like to think of our land as these like very discrete geographical boundaries. And it's not separated necessarily by bodies of water or a body of water. But in the case of Micronesia, if you have an island that you live on, and then there's another island you're allowed to go fishing or hunting around, it's kind of like just going to the extent of your farmland, right? If you have 30 acres or whatever, you just go to the other, if you're going to the other side of it, it's kind of the same idea. In the 70s, I think it was during, it was like the Law of the Sea discussion. And I think UNESCO was involved in that. This came up a lot, actually, the concept of water and the concept of land. And I think we as Americans, I think initially we think of, okay, we got all this land and it's just contiguous and we just keep going. With water, it might be seen as a barrier. Water's seen as a pathway. It is not a barrier. It's the grocery store and it's the boat route. It's the sailing route. It's, you know, it's a way to get from A to B, and it might be faster, honestly, at times, especially. I like to make a joke with my friends out there. First of all, there's this phrase coconut wireless, and it just refers to communicating verbally. Like you tell somebody something and then they tell whatever, they tell another person. And so me and my, one of my girlfriends in Yap, she and I joke about this because the internet can be so slow. I'm like, you know, I bet I could send a message with somebody flying out of Koshai today and it would get to you faster than if I sent it via Facebook, because we don't know when you're getting online or if the internet will be working by the time you get, you know, this message leaves. And so we joke around and we're like, oh, coconut wireless is faster. There are definitely some differences in how we conceive of where we are. And I know that, you know, it's a bit of the environmental determinism. It doesn't have to be that way, but we can't lie to ourselves and say that our environment doesn't shape the way we think about things and that it is different. It can be different from other places. But I, you know, living out there, I just think to myself, you know, everything I needed to know about life, I learned from living in Micronesia. We're not that different in terms of being humans and human desires, but the way we go about it, you know, that's the age old aspect of anthropology, is that it It's expressed differently, group to group and micro group to micro group. And so it's really cool to see how that is done out there. And I like it. Like, I identify really well with that. I can't remember when it started, but I think it was in college, undergrad. I've just wanted to move to the Pacific. Like, that's just my objective. I want to go to the Pacific. I want to live there. I want to be an anthropologist there. And I don't know where it came from, but there's something about being out there that feels very comfortable and natural to me.
Did you visit when you were younger, or was it like something just kind of got in your bones that you, like, did you read something? I'm wondering, like a video or something, or whatever. I don't know. You just got the call of the Pacific.
So it was before I moved to Hawaii. I hadn't really gone outside the United States except for like a cruise that my parents, they took us on when I was in undergrad. And so we stopped in a couple of places, and that was the extent of it. I had never visited outside of the Caribbean, and I went to school in Georgia. Nothing there. I think I just, if anything, when I was really young, around 7 years old, I was in Montessori school. So Montessori school comes with, you know, self-teaching, learning how to self-teach, independence, independent learning, those kinds of things. And I just thought, you know, communication's really important. Like, I think this was during the time of, I want to say the Gulf War. Anyway, there was some war going on. And I just thought, you know, why do they have to fight? This is not necessary. Maybe I could just like talk between these groups, and like, maybe they're just having a misunderstanding. And so I became very determined to learn Spanish at a very early age, so that the other options were president and an astronaut. Yeah, I mean, I was serious about becoming the first president. And then I just thought, you know, I'm not really sure I'm going to be able to accomplish that much as a president. And then the astronaut thing, I just really did not like the G-forces that I experienced in Huntsville, Alabama. So flying was a major part of becoming an astronaut. And I just thought, nope, that's not for me. So they sound kind of naive, but those were my three things that I wanted to do when I was younger. And so being a like a cultural mediator was the one that I really followed. And so Spanish had been part of my life for a long time, all the way into undergrad. I just wanted to learn Spanish. Like, I didn't have a really good reason for getting a degree in Spanish other than I wanted to study Spanish. That was it. I just wanted to study Spanish, and actually international business too. And I just kept telling myself, no, like, don't get a degree in Spanish, like, get something functional. And my parents were like, whatever, do whatever you like. Like, if you like Spanish, just do it. You'll figure something out. So, while I was in denial about how much I loved learning Spanish, I studied computer science and photography and art history, information technology. And, all of that ended up going towards like, business minor and something, you know, stuff like that. So the Spanish, I think somewhere in the middle of learning Spanish, I read about South America and the importance. I think for me, I felt like biological knowledge was very much wrapped up in local languages. And I felt that documentation was a very important thing to do to protect that knowledge until we understood it better. And then we could decide what to do with it, you know, collectively as a species, not necessarily Americans or South Americans in general. So anyhow, that's where Hawaii came in. I wanted to go to Hawaii to learn sociolinguistics because my Spanish degree, I had a Spanish linguist in for one of my classes. And she opened up my world. She taught me everything that I could possibly be curious about as an undergrad in sociolinguistics. And so that's when I moved to Hawaii. And I think, as I was moving out to Hawaii, that's when I just decided that I was going to the Pacific. I don't know why.
I'm saying, it's amazing that you both like then felt it, wanted it, and then did it though too, which is admirable.
I ended up going to graduate school in Alaska, and I was in an applied linguistics program and did a bit of documentation with Alaska languages. And then I had I don't know how it happened, but basically I was really not an applied linguist. I was really thinking like an anthropologist, and someone pointed this out to me. And so I switched graduate programs, and I went to anthropology, and I had been developing a proposal in my applied linguistics program to focus on language in chat. chat rooms. I felt that this was important because we were increasingly communicating in a digital world and we wouldn't have all the usual cues. This wasn't a very popular topic at the time. It was not supported. And it was, and in anthropology up there, it was in comparison to how much I had thought about Hawaii and talked about Hawaii, the department was like, why don't you focus on Hawaii for your thesis? So that's how that happened.
Like chat rooms in Hawaii? They're like, no, language. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it, despite what I thought I wanted to do, it still happened, but in a different way. And now I use linguistics a lot. I don't document languages, but the linguistics background helps a lot. And guess what? I use Spanish a lot.
That's interesting. So I would not expect that in Micronesia.
You know, I had no idea how I was going to put them together because other than Spanish colonization, I really had no idea how Spanish and the Pacific were going to go together. And I just figured, you know what, if I really like Spanish, then I'm just going to keep speaking Spanish. And if I like the Pacific, I'm just going to keep living out there. And then one project, we were looking for some stuff and there it was in Spanish about Yap.
Interesting. You're like, ha, see, got it.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from this episode's sponsor. We'll be right back. The world is big until you start moving around and realize how small it actually is. And then we see those connectivity, right? I'd say like one lesson for the kids listening is that you can study Spanish and get a job in the South Pacific. It's okay.
Probably the best, one of the best pieces of advice I got from my parents was to just do it because you like it and the rest will work itself out. I think that those were the actual words of my dad.
We have to hope it's funny too, because even like we're talking up top in terms of the need to go with the flow in terms of scheduling, you know, ethnographic work with folks. Sounds like this too. It's like, it'll work out. You just got to like not overly plan it but stick to it. You know, obviously it's like you are a cultural anthropologist in the, is it like the National Archives branch of the government in Micronesia. How did that even happen? Because most people, like, there's not usually a cultural anthropology, you type cultural anthropology jobs, that doesn't show up unless I'm looking in the wrong place.
I do not know where it came from, but when I was in graduate school, I really wanted to, like, I wanted to be called a cultural anthropologist. I don't know why. It just, I was going to school for that. And I just, it was one of the, you know, I went into anthropology because that's the way I think, that's the way I like to think, that's the way I like to interact. And then when I was thinking about jobs, I hadn't really thought about what I would be called. And I mean, that's one of the age old problems with anthropology as a degree anyways, you never really know what you're going to be called. And so it was really cool to actually be in a position where that's what I'm called, that's what I do, and it's respected. I think that in terms of finding the job, I was just looking for it. The National Park Service still uses this title, actually. And then the National Park came from working with the national government. So initially I was the Yap State anthropologist and then Cochrane State and then national. Even though I still helped out with things at national level, it had a matter to do with where my contract was located and the kind of work that I was doing. So yeah, so it was really through the National Park Service and a listserv that I was on coming together, and then I saw it. And then one of my cohort friends had actually had the job before, but I didn't apply because I wasn't ready, but he had already gone. And so I had known about it from that that angle as well.
So in this case, like, so the U.S. National Park Service has like foreign service jobs. Is that like, how is it categorized? Or is it like, this is purely in Micronesia, or is it not the U.S. Park Service? Is it like the Micronesian Park Service?
I knew that the title cultural anthropologist existed in the National Park Service, the U.S. one. The position itself in the FSM, it's paid via grant funding from the National Park Service, but it's appropriated by the Federated States of Micronesia. So it's totally their call who they hire and what they, yeah. So, and there's no, it's not really the Micronesia, like there's none of that. It's just that there's a National Historic Preservation Office, which is the National Archives. And then there are four state HPOs, and they reside inside of other government agencies. So in Yap, it's in the Department of Youth and Civic Affairs. In Chuuk, it's in Commerce and Industry. And then in Pohnpei, it's Department of Land and Resources. And in Koshrae, it's Koshrae Island Resource Management Authority. So they all put their historic offices in different agencies, which is really cool. And actually, it reminds me to share that that was one of the things that I didn't expect, but I'm glad it happened, and I was hopeful for it. The intersection of historic preservation and conservation. We actually get to do a lot of that, and ethnography is at the center of that. For example, like the stingray in Pohnpei, the stingray is called Nono. It also means mother. It's a clan animal. And guess what? There's a stingray sanctuary. It's a historic site in the sense that there's an ethnographic component to it, but it's not a structure, is what I mean. You know, sometimes with the historic preservation that goes on in the United States, it's really about structures and it's about physical sites. And that's why Keith Basso's work was so important. And also the traditional cultural properties that King talked about and Parker talked about, you know, landscapes, they don't have to have built structures on them to be important. And so it's really central out there, I would say. Don't get me wrong, we have structures, but ethnography is very important to telling both sides. Right, the ethnographic and the archaeological side to have a more complete story, and that's a concept that's very well practiced, respected, appreciated, and encouraged out there.
And that's really interesting too, because I mean, I think that is a really valuable point, you know, for folks if they're listening who are not in the South Pacific. Like, if you have an idea that oftentimes ethnography and archaeology seem different in terms of like when they get plugged in, and so if you have historic preservation. Or conservation too, getting into biology and like the environment too. It's like they don't always get used together, right? Archaeologists are like, oh, I'm working on a site, and like they sometimes will do kind of like modern archaeology where they're also talking with living populations, but oftentimes not. Sometimes you can't, but like it's an interesting idea in terms of how they're really well intertwined, because we're not necessarily talking about a specific site in a place, you know, that's a built to land form and that actually is just like a sanctuary. Is really cool. And like, that's a nice idea to remind that like there's value in why anthropology is holistic, right? And that like, we need more examples of it, I think, across the anthropological spectrum globally to say, oh yes, that's right. This is actually why they work together, right? Why we need to have both or more.
No, you're right. And it's, how do I explain it? So when I first started out there, I was asked to stick to the basics. That's what the office needed. They wanted an intensive level ethnographic survey, and that's exactly what I did. I went by the book, I went by the scientific method, the population, the number of participants, you know, the whole nine yards. Over the years, it's encouraged me to rethink the scientific method, what it means to have a scientific method, and what it means to be able to replicate a study, and why that is considered scientific. As I've gone through it, you know, 30 isn't necessarily the magic number if you don't have 30 people. but there are other ways to learn about something than just an algebraic, formulaic, however you want to call it, way of doing things. And so it's definitely challenged my thinking that I had acquired from graduate school in a better and more holistic way. It's made me think about companies like Apple and Google, Facebook, what's the other one? Intel, and Southwest, and also JCPenney. Maybe with the exception, see, Facebook doesn't call them anthropologists. I think they call them user experience people. And then I think Google might be somewhere between that, and I don't think they say anthropologist either. Southwest, if I'm not mistaken, they have an anthropology department. Intel, they have a team of anthropologists. I think this was recent, and I was totally impressed that they bothered to hire an anthropologist, and for a chip, it was too cool. And so it's just made me more thoughtful about the ways that we can be, the ways that we have anthropologists on the whole have not been used to their fullest potential, if you ask me. our field is so useful. I appreciate that the Federated States of Micronesia realizes, both in accounting terms, but also like they know, they realize the benefit of an anthropologist. So going back to my first couple of years out there, there are a ton of development projects out there. Everybody wants to help develop and make this developing economy a developed economy. And you know what? They don't include ethnography as much as they do. But the projects that they do include ethnography go really well. And those companies tend to stay out there. And those projects tend to last. And so increasingly, they're calling our office to be involved, to inform things ethnographically. They already know where the sites are because the in the beginning, when the U.S. had much more of a, there was a territorial historic preservation office. So it was all about site. And so they documented sites, GPS points. So now people are going back and like confirming those, taking new pictures, that kind of stuff. But the ethnography that was done was, it was different. And also ethnography changes, right? Like what we learn about one topic 100 years ago is not going to be the same that we learn about today. And so it's made me more thoughtful about the differences. So there's the ethnographic part of informing projects, but it's made me more thoughtful about the role of ethnography versus metadata. It's definitely made me think a lot more about data in general, what it tells us, what we're learning, how do we get it? And in graduate school, I remember one of my cohort friends pointed out, he's like, you know, if you perform the scientific method and you select the methods to get the data, you know, appropriate for collecting data, of course you're going to get the data that you expect to get. Like, where's the mystery in that? And I was like, well, you know, you do have to pick the appropriate method and you don't always know. And then of course the paradigm is has a role as well. Collecting a bunch of data doesn't mean you know anything more. It means you have a lot of data.
I spend more time in tech spaces than I do island nations, although I'd like to spend more time in island nations. But to your point, like, I think there's a really valuable, like, I love this idea of like, how do we think about ethnography in relationship to metadata? And what is like, yeah, what's the collection methods? How are we like collating it, cataloging, tagging the data? What are we doing with it? And, you know, ethnography as this like flow of record, you know, in essence, in terms of meaning and connections and associations. And so it's like putting the data in context. It's been interesting to see tech companies start to wrestle with that, you know, in the past decade, maybe a little longer. Like, you know, Xerox PARC has been doing it since like the 70s, which is really crazy. In terms of like trying to bring anthropological thinking into spaces, but then like, yeah, in tech spaces, we see it in market research. We're seeing it a little bit more, not quite as much still, you know, the, how do we take seriously like the associative power of anthropology that, like, I think you said something also that's super important that like FSM is like, it matters. They're putting money behind anthropology, right? Like, it's like, we have to invest in this form of thinking, doing knowledge making, you know, sharing, if it's to continue, for one, which is like, that's a dull statement, but also true. Cause it's like, we often find that one of the biggest challenges is that academia doesn't know how to translate or talk about what it can do elsewhere. And so if we are people working in applied or design anthropological spaces, you know, it doesn't always translate back either. And so it's this really interesting idea to be like, well, one way to show is like, what is money going behind? And if we can see going behind anthropologists, like, it's great. And then on top of that, like, I imagine you have a super rich data set of like the projects where people hired an ethnographer for development or conservation or anything go a lot better in terms of longevity and like finance and impact and community engagement and all the things, right? And those, like, that itself is like a metadata story. That's not the scientific method, which is great. Like, you're using the scientific method to pick up data and understand stories, but then like the bigger picture is like, well, look, this wouldn't have happened. Like, we can see this, like, this is evidence that this is taking place, that like ethnography has value. That's super important, you know, to see that. And it's like very cool to think about that translationally into like tech and data too.
We use water, rainwater, catchment water, and it gets filtered and then we can drink that. There's also a spring, and then there's a lot of bottled water that is imported and purchased. And I didn't understand why this was, other than it might be convenient at events, funerals or birthdays, weddings, et cetera, because they're outside. And then we were on survey in one of the more remote parts of the island. There's a road to it, but the road is so treacherous, nobody drives there. They take a boat. So we were having conversations with each other around this little like pool of water. I wanted to like check it out, and they pointed out that there were frogs in there. I was like, okay. We started talking more about what water's okay to drink, what water's not. And they explained that they don't like to drink any other water than the bottled water because flies land on poop, frogs eat flies, and frogs live in these freshwater sources. So they considered the water dirty. Now, from a metadata perspective, it would be more like, okay, we know that there are a lot of plastic bottles being thrown away on the island, right? That's your data. And then your metadata would be maybe the volume of it or what happens to it or whatever. But it doesn't tell the part about why it's happening. And I mean, as much as it tries to, it's still something that it can be put into a spreadsheet. I'm not saying that qualitative data can't be put into a spreadsheet. It totally can, but it still has to be organized. And I think that when I think about ethnography and metadata, that's something that I think that metadata is missing. It's missing the human voice. Just because you collect data doesn't mean it tells you everything. We can collect all the data we want, you know, the metadata, but it's still I think it's missing a human component, a human interaction that's special. And it has to be described by those who are involved in that conversation. It can't be described by a computer, maybe. I'm not an AI, so I don't know. Maybe you could tell more that since you're in the tech world.
The good thing is AI is not that smart yet, so we're still needed.
It's an interesting concept. I'd like to see them, I'd like to see them try to do that one. We're just so dynamic, you know. Culture's not static, all that. I'd really like to see somebody develop some code for that. I mean, I'm not unfamiliar with code. I remember writing computer programs, and I always think back to the 50-50 when you flip a coin.
Oh, heads or tails thing.
That's it. Yeah. So one of our assignments was to write a heads or tails program in code. I had to write the algorithm for this. Well, it's no longer random. I have to write the algorithm for this. So I never really think of random as random anymore because it's not. To me, there's something behind it that can explain the outcome. So with programming, when it comes to AI, it still has to be adaptive. And guess who writes that code? Humans write that code.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's like two things that need to happen there. One is that so much of the secularized Western world could do well by adding a bit more enchantment to their lives. And then the other side is we need to disenchant data as if it's some magic source of truth, you know, especially when it's collected by a heads or tails app that we've written. It's like, that's fine. But like that metadata matters, like how it was created and who made it and what does it do? You know, I agree with you there too, because it's like interpretation is something only we can do. Like that we're a storytelling species and we interpret everything, right? We give things names and we give them play. We have double code languages, right? On top of languages. And like, you're never going to see the fact that like there's a health frog concern, you know, with drinking fresh water versus bottled water, you know, and it's like, that's important or to even like understand. Yeah. Why it is that we do what we do. I think that is really powerful and it's nice to recognize that, like, of course there's such value also in seeing that comparative perspective, you know, in that regard. We learn actually some of the best stuff by thinking this way too, where it's like, okay, what do we see there? What do we see here? And like, what are the commonalities and differences? And data is an important part that we need to interrogate, right? Because it's like, it's the stuff that we say we know, but it's like, but how do we know it? How was it made? It gives you a what, doesn't give you a why.
You make a really good point that data is, I don't think you said this exactly, but what I got from it is that the data we extract, but computers can't assign meaning or a program can't assign meaning. And that's something that we do. So the interpretation process and then ascribing that meaning to what we're doing, that's not something that a program can do yet that I'm aware of. So I think it's a really good point that you made. One's extractive and one's, well, input, really.
That's a good point. Meaning as input. I like it. Also as output too. It's kind of both, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely some output. Back to Keith Basso, right?
That's right. So coming back to Keith Basso, it's crazy. I really enjoyed kind of thinking about this so far. I'm curious too, like, what are one or two things that people wouldn't know, you know, that you work as an anthropologist that's like surprising? Because it's like, A, I was surprised, like when we got in contact, I was like, whoa, you're a cultural anthropologist for the Federated States of Micronesia. How did that? But then on top of that, so like that was surprising in general, but like on top of that, I know there's some, I mean, in the stories you've been shared so far have been super, so rich in terms of the kinds of work, the people you meet, what you're digging into. But like, I'm just, what are like one or two, like if you're at a party and you want to surprise somebody, what are two things that you'd pull out to like, bet you didn't know I do this?
That's a good one. Wow.
Or what surprised you when you first started, even too, another way to think about that.
So the things that my friends are, that they've expressed that they're surprised by, have to do with entrepreneurship and then also emotional intelligence and awareness. I think what surprises them the most is that there's, so if I think about all of that as one topic, that there are 18 different languages spoken out there. There are 4 high islands. More importantly, the 18 languages that are spoken, we can say that there are 18 different cultural groups. So Micronesians may be the larger, and that's a region, right? It's not just FSM. So I think the diversity is surprising, but more that I'm working within that diversity and juggling several cultures, several languages, not by myself though. I have coworkers, and so we do this together. Sometimes they're surprised that I'm still out there because it's a different way of life. It is a very different way of life. You have to really want to live where you live. And I think that growing up, I just didn't see myself living in Georgia. I just didn't. But maybe my friends, they just didn't think about living outside of the U.S. or living outside of their country. It's not just a U.S. thing, right? My friends all over the world, they can't imagine living outside of where they are. And that's fine. So I think, and then the entrepreneurial aspect, I've gotten creative. Me and my coworkers, we have to come up with creative solutions to carry out what we do. So we've been very resourceful and entrepreneurial about it. I hadn't really thought about that, but my friends pointed it out. And the more I think about it, I'm like, yeah, you're right. That's a good point. I think in terms of work, that's what they're pretty surprised about. And then for me, I think that I'm just surprised at how much I get to bring together all my interests. So linguistics, Spanish, anthropology, geography, conservation, natural resources. The bat in Kosrae is a keystone species for the island, and it's responsible for cross-pollination of breadfruit. So there are about 40 different types of breadfruit. It's a big part of the Makintowe Conservation Area, which we used ethnography and archaeology to inform the boundaries, the site itself. So I think I'm just surprised, and maybe not surprised anymore. I'm just so grateful that I get to bring it all together, because it's like I don't have to pick. We get to do all of it. So I think that's pretty cool.
That's like such an inspirational thing to realize. It's like you don't really have, you don't have to pick actually. Like there are ways to do this and bring all the pieces together.
Maybe for me, it's what was missing in academia was being able to apply all this. Sometimes I sat in the classes and I just thought, you know, it's nice that we can point out problems, but what are we doing about it? You know, let's go do something about it. We do need academia, don't get me wrong. And I think that with my office in FSM, they're very much aware of that. I do publish, not as often as maybe someone in a university, but I do publish. I present, make video, I do lots of things with my coworkers. We write together. And we work with the communities to produce articles that are meaningful and palatable for them as well. Things that they want published. So I don't just publish anything. I actually have a report that is never going to be published because it's that way. So
I love that too. But that's also important, you know, because it's like, and I appreciate too, like a kind of across this conversation too. It's an interrogation also of like, what does it mean to be an applied anthropologist? But I mean, also you might agree with me too, where it's just like, well, let's just call us anthropologists. We don't need to be applied. You know, we don't have to add applied to it because really the reverse of that means unapplied.
I would agree with that. Yeah. I think we're all anthropologists. I mean, even at academics are, some academic anthropologists do applied work. Some of them even get called in to comment on policy, but they're also contributing to publication, which I think is a part of being applied. Now, sometimes it ends up on 10 people's desk and that's all who will ever read it, but popularizing what we're doing, or like pop science, right? To make it more palatable or understandable by people who don't spend a lot of time with this field would be a good thing to do, but that's an age old argument.
Age old conundrum, right? So the last chunk I want to add to that is like, because thinking about, I think it's a really great and important point of like, how do we popularizing the work is part of the work, you know, part of the work is like documenting and helping people solve the problems they want to solve using our toolkit. But the other side of it is like, how do we help socialize or popularize that? And so when I saw that you had also been working like with UNESCO, you know, World Heritage Sites as in an arena of how do we bring different cultural heritage sites to UNESCO's awareness and then apply for that. That to me is, I think, a really fascinating question circulating around the idea of how do we popularize it. I mean, it's like different, not that everybody goes and like knows what a UNESCO World Heritage Site is, but a lot of people do. A lot of people know what UNESCO is, right? And so that seems like a really interesting other way to kind of combine the work of preservation and conservation, both in terms of like keeping languages and histories alive, also sites alive, you know, building in entrepreneurship like ecotourism, but then also adding in other possibilities like international recognition, laws that could protect sites in new ways. So I want to hear just a bit about this part. This is also one of the things that surprised me when we're kind of like talking through some ideas in that I think it's very cool and noble to like be able to have that as part of your work too. That's like, hey, UNESCO, come here. We actually need to talk about these heritage sites. So how did, like, I want to hear a bit about that. Like, how did that come up? And to me also is another example of like, you have to do it all.
Our National Historic Preservation Officer, Augustine Kohler, he's one of the most enthusiastic people I've met when it comes to historic preservation. Historic conservation is what we've been calling it more recently. So he's wanting to get he wants to work on one site per island for UNESCO World Heritage. And so that has been one of the objectives since he's been the National Historic Preservation Officer. And so we actually worked to carry that out. And Nan Madol was inscribed in 2016. And now we're working on Chuuk Lagoon and the Mangyol Stone Money site. And then in Koshai, we have, it could be combined or it could be separate. We don't know, but there's the Lela Ruins, which is... It's similar in architecture, just a smaller site by comparison to Nan Madol. And then the Makinsowe Conservation Area, which would be a mixed site. So they're part of our natural work. Those are objectives that we want to do. And we utilize our ethnographic surveys to help inform that. So it's a very, for us, it's become a systematic process. I think before it was more like, let's see what we can put together. But under the way that we've been doing it, it's been systematic. We carry out the surveys that are necessary for preparing the application. And there's a lot of international communication. So it's not just FSM, the United States. It's also professionals who are in Australia or Japan who have interest in the area. And so it's very much a team effort and cross-cultural communication, internet connectivity. There's a lot that goes on. And then increasingly, UNESCO is interested to see LIDAR surveys versus on-foot surveys. And those are very expensive. So that can challenge our ability to submit a nomination. We do have a lot of things that we do, and the National Register is another one of those prestigious things that we're working toward. And we can have a national, we can participate in the National Register with the U.S. or we can do it on our own. They're both recognized, which is a nice feature to the relationship between FSM and the U.S., the Compact of Free Association. When we did the ICH nomination, so another aspect of UNESCO increasingly is that the communities are on board. That it's not even that they're on board. I hate this term, getting people on board. It's like highly manipulative, honestly. So we always talk with our communities first. The islands operate governmentally from the ground up. And so if the communities are not on board, it does not go forward. It just does not. Yeah, so the ICH nomination, we had to get in contact with people in the Outer Islands that get flights maybe once a week or once every 2 weeks, and the boats maybe go once every couple of weeks. So it's not an easy thing to get community consensus, but also getting the support at the same time. So you really have to spend a lot of time with the communities. And sometimes we went to an Outer Island in Chuuk. They'd never heard of UNESCO. How can you ethically, I mean, okay, not you specifically, how can I ethically write an application for an ICH nomination if the people that I'm talking to do not know what it is? I need them to understand the ramifications, both positive and negative, and everything in between, before I can ethically put an application forward and say, yes, our communities want this. It's just such a big deal, and it has so many impacts, and they aren't always they're not intended to be bad, but they're not always intended to be good. And so it's important that the communities know what it is and how they can use it. So it's just, it's a very complicated application. They take time for a reason. It is a very good example of applied anthropology. since we're agreeing that anthropology is just applied, it should be applied across the board. But it is a very good use of anthropology. And honestly, writing one of those applications is, it's a lot like writing a thesis. You can't you have to give a very concise description of why that element is important and why that element is of outstanding universal value. Just because it exists doesn't mean it's important to everyone, but it's important that we let them know why it's important.
And that's also a nice plug. So in case you thought your thesis was useless, it's actually quite useful if you're trying to do something big, like apply for a intangible world heritage site.
So I think one of the questions that you had asked, maybe not so directly, but it was about having that recognition or what it means to have national or international recognition for FSM sites. And I want to go back to one of your other podcasts. It was about the 30 meter telescope. So in 2015, I was there when the proposal was being put forward. And I was there as part of the outreach team. And I heard about it, all that. There were some rules that were broken, basically. And then in 2015, I was teaching a cultural anthropology class, and there were protests from around the world for that telescope, against it, actually. And so I think that's the reason, I think that's the significance of the international recognition, is that others are aware of its importance and that they can support you. Because if we just work off of population alone, some sites are so important, but they might only have 100 people that actually live in that area, right? So when it came to the 30 meter telescope protest, videos were sent in from around the world to protest going forward with this telescope. I mean, so I think that's one of the reasons for, I'm sure there are a lot of them, time doesn't allow, but that's something that really stood out to me when you asked that question.
There can be a naivety or an excitement that we want to get something that's for ICH or get an international recognition, but it's why? Right. And what's it for? And so in this case, that's like thinking of Mauna Kea in terms of as a sacred site versus a scientific observatory. How do you actually then think about what's legitimate in that space and for whom? Right. And so international recognition is a double-edged sword in this case, where it's you can protest against it because you're building on indigenous sacred land, or, it harkens and echoes typical colonial problems, right? Of eminent domain, of the government is taking the space. But then international protest can be no, this is, we actually stand with the people. So it is interesting. Yeah. It's we live in a really interesting era that we can think about intangible and tangible cultural heritage and fight for it globally. And that is really interesting, and also get recognition. So it's it's a curious time.
Thanks to media platforms, of course.
Thanks to the low cost of messaging on Facebook Messenger.
I think it was it might have been a page on Facebook where people were posting their videos. Some of my students they posted as well. And anyway, so it was beautiful to see that there was a lot of support against the telescope, because there are already so many up there. And then the age old argument, it's good for jobs. Okay, for how long?
And for whom? Right, jobs for whom?
Right. And then the other age old argument, this is what your ancestors were doing a long time ago. They were looking at the stars differently, though. Yeah, it's just a different narrative, and one that really didn't involve the local people that well. So, you're right. It could go the other way as well. What if people are really we really need it to be built up there. Okay, we're all going to protest that it be built there. It could go the other way.
That's the thing. It's just as long as we allow space for people power, right? In terms of and that's why, I'm quite encouraged to hear just in terms of the way that you're approaching these issues, right? And what does it mean to get that international recognition? It's we have to get folks on board, and a legit ethical question. So listeners, if you have any thoughts of what is the ethical question there in terms of what can I do ethically if we're going to apply for something that the people that need to have consensus with don't know what the thing is, can we apply? It's a really, really fast. It's an important question, though. I'm encouraged to hear you wrestling with it, and because I think it's important. That's the hard but good part of anthropology too, right?
It is, yeah. I mean, I feel like it's such a central part of being an anthropologist, to be reflexive, to be. I mean, it is, right. We're taught all of that, but the emotional intelligence aspect and self-awareness. It's one thing to write a nomination. There's a lot of prestige, right? To be the person or the group of people that write that nomination. But we really have to put ourselves aside and say, you know, what's best here? How do we best guide and inform our communities about this thing that we had in mind to do? Do we continue to support it if they say yes, but we don't really see that they understand what it means? And so I think that our office has handled that really well by working with the communities and hearing what they want, how they want to go about it. Because honestly, at the end of the day, let's say that we just went forward with a nomination and we didn't really achieve proper consensus. What happens when you implement care for that site? If they don't know what they're doing, or they don't know how to do it, or they don't know what it means, or all of a sudden they're like thousands of visitors in their backyard, and they're like, wait, why are all these people here and I'm not collecting a fee? If they didn't know that they could collect a fee and there's no fee set up, well, they might be a bit upset. So I think that the more information people have on the front end, the better able they can make decisions and handle things along the way than just having some plan implemented on them rather than together. And so I think long term, it's just not worth all the hassle just because people said, yeah, okay, let's do it. And they don't understand the extent of it. So we do outreach is a huge part of what we do, communication and having a historic preservation officer. So each state has a historic preservation officer, and those positions are very important. Those are the connections to the communities. It's important that they're social, that they're well-liked, that they are trusted, and that they do a good job. I think more importantly, that they do a good job at all of those things. I was very fortunate to work with a historic preservation officer who had basically been there since the beginning, and he knew he had surveyed almost all the sites that had ever been surveyed. So whenever I had a question, he knew exactly what I was talking about. And then during the pandemic, we were trying to get out of the office because we didn't really know what was going on. So we just thought, you know, let's be outside in open air. And so he took us to historic sites, and he would tell us stories about those sites that he had learned. And he also was preparing our new historic preservation officer in Kushai by doing that. So he was imparting his knowledge onto the staff before he retired. So it had multiple purposes, really a beautiful thing. And he was a fantastic officer. He told us that every day can become history, so we should document it. It was just too cool that he thought in that way. And he's right. You know, someday a building will be 50 years old, and someday a practice might not be practiced anymore. And so he was a really integral part to our video ethnography. And he taught me a lot about ethnography in Kushai, in the sense that, we were able to move away from me asking the questions and getting them translated by the staff to the elders being prompted with a topic, and they impart their knowledge onto the youth. So our ethnography actually doesn't go through me. It goes directly to the youth, which was the whole point anyway. It was for the youth to learn, right? So our elders talk with the youth, and they were so excited about one of the topics that we focused on. It was navigation. They had a vocational hour in high school, and they decided to create a club, the navigation club. And then they would come over to our office twice a week, and we would invite our elders to come share stories about navigation, all kinds of navigation, not just aquatic and or marine. Then we had a few boats that came into Kushai that they sailed from New Zealand or Fiji or, you know, whatever. And then we would have them come in and talk about the importance of ethnography and documentation of navigational knowledge and how it informs GPS devices. And so not only did they hear from their elders, but they heard from people who use the stars. They continue to use the stars, but they also use with GPS devices. So the kids were very into that and created their own club so that they could hang out with historic preservation people twice a week. But our officer, he really encouraged that transmission. And it wasn't to like cut me out or anything, but if the point of historic preservation was to share the knowledge with the youth, I still get to read the transcripts, but the kids get it directly. Why not?
Thanks once again to Ashley Meredith for joining me on the podcast today. I can say that I am really inspired and find it empowering to know that there are organizations, countries, government offices interested and willing to put funding and support behind anthropologists and anthropological work in the world. There's also this crucial issue of what does heritage preservation and conservation mean today? I found it really valuable to hear Ashley's emphasis on ethics and that communities need to have a say and an understanding of the potential impacts of recognition projects like UNESCO's World Heritage Sites and intangible cultural heritage. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts here. What are some of the roles that you'd like to see more anthropologists or social scientists in? And perhaps you know one, or maybe you are one, and you'd like to share your story on the podcast as well. Hit me up on thisanthrolife.org. Also, as we careen into summer and fall, help me with a TAL takeover. What's that? Well, do you have an idea for an episode or a guest? Or have you been itching to interview someone that you admire? Or do you have a story that you want to tell about why anthropology matters in the world today for business, technology, design, whatever it is? Or are you interested in writing blog posts to accompany TAL episodes? If so, I want to hear from you. I'm talking guest hosting, interviews, producing, and writing. I'm trying an experiment in opening up the TAL mic and newsletter to more voices and writers. So let's collaborate and help me make this TAL takeover a success. If you're interested, get in contact with me over at thisanthrolife.org. As always, I cannot wait to hear from you. It's been a pleasure to be with you and share and listenership and friendship and all the other good stuff in between. So hope to see you next time. And as always, I'm Adam Gamwell, and this is This Anthro Life. See ya. This episode was produced and edited by Imani Nichols with Whisper and Mutter.